John, your father flew this airplane?
That's right, on that mission.
On that first mission with Tibbetts and the B-17s.
That's correct, yes.
Tell us about your memories, the things you learned from your dad about his experience flying this airplane in the squadron.
Well, he was probably pretty typical of the average RAF fighter pilot at the time. He was very young. He joined at 19. By the time he flew this, he was an experienced fighter pilot. He just turned 21, just been commissioned as a pilot officer, which is the same as a second lieutenant in the US Air Force. He's a typical example of an ordinary man being asked to do extraordinary things. And there were hundreds like him, and he was lucky enough to survive. But he'd spent the first year or so flying with 64 Squadron and A Flight, and he'd been...
Now, that was a squadron, right? A
British, that's right,
64 Squadron.
That's correct.
Right.
So A Flight was six aircraft roughly in each flight. And he told me that he had spent the first part of his flying career in the Air Force turning very tightly with a little bit of top rudder to avoid being shot down by the German aircraft in his rearview mirror, which you can see up on top of the cockpit there. When they started flying the Spitfire 9, which he referred to as a wizard kite, and his all-time favorite mark of Spitfire, he said for the first time he was in a situation where he was doing some of the chasing.
Wow. When you just mentioned he started flying at 19, then he was 21, I wonder how many of us can think about on a regular basis who, for the most part, actually fought World War II. And it was 19, 20, 21, 22-year-olds. One person who comes to mind, Bud Anderson, who will be here, is currently America's living highest-ranking ace. Bud, in 1944, flew 116 missions. In 1942, in 1 year, had 16 and a quarter air victories, and he was 22 years old. So that's something I think a lot of us tend not to think about. What comes to your mind about that? You two guys fly all these airplanes.
Well, what BR-601 has taught us is there were about 40 pilots that flew this airplane. And the hard thing about thinking about that time is we can look at a person like Bud who had a tremendous string of I mean, he was a fantastic fighter pilot. There's absolutely no, but that's what we have to remember. This airplane was built in June of 1942. It was one of the first, and so they built 16 of these in June. Those 16 airplanes were reduced to 4 by January 1st, 1943. The 100 airplanes that they built that were modified, fully 70 of them did not survive World War II. Fully 40 of them didn't survive 1942, which was just a matter of months. So the one thing I would like to stress just is that we can't conceive of being a 17-kill ace. That's big. But you have to remember that there were 99 other men that served in a grouping of 100. Probably 5 maybe shot down another airplane. You know, 4 or 5 didn't shoot down anybody but survived the war, and then the other 70 or so didn't make it.
And the story also it tells in the aircraft's 121 missions that it flew in World War II, 40 of them were escorting 8th Bomber Command aircraft. So not only that first mission, it escorted Memphis Belle 4 times, including the legendary 25th mission. It was flying escort on the first B-24 mission, the first B-26 mission before they were 9th Air Force, the first P-38 mission, and so on. It was there for so many of these events. And it was a multinational effort. As I mentioned, Norwegians, Belgian, New Zealand, Australian pilots were all there saving American lives. So not only were there 19, 20-year-olds in this airplane, but it's how many hundreds of our airmen made it home as a result of it. And that's a bit telling of our unpreparedness. We didn't have an escort fighter at that time. We sent over P-38s that were not prepared and they weren't able to do that, and we didn't have enough aircraft. And the missions were short. They weren't going deep into Europe. They're going into France, Holland. We weren't going deep into Germany. But even when we did, they were still flying over occupied territory. In fact, when this airplane was finally retired, we still hadn't invaded Europe and had flown for 2 years. So every mission they had was a dangerous mission. And even when we had P-47s with drop tanks that could go a longer distance into Europe, they were vulnerable. So it's unusual to see this airplane flying escort for fighters. But to get across the coast, to get them further into Europe, they had to do that. Because the Germans knew, hey, just jump those P-47s with drop tanks. They're going to pop their tanks off to engage, to defend themselves. And then they're not going all the way, you know, deeper into Germany to defend the bombers.
Yeah. How significant was this airplane engine to the development of the P-51 Mustang?
This is the engine which developed into the Packard Merlin Dash 7 that you see in all the Mustangs out here. So it started off as a Merlin 61, and it was a prototype motor. It was something that Rolls-Royce came up with on their own because they realized the RAF needed something. They needed to go higher. The Mark V, you'll hear pilots today that talk about it. Beautiful flying airplane, and that's wonderful. But it wasn't a good weapon. This weaponized the Spitfire to fly higher. This is where the fight was. It was able to take on Focke-Wulfs, which the Mark V really was not up to the task. And when John talked about his father saying this was the best airplane, if you read all of the pilot reports, that's what they were saying. This is the plane they wanted. And a few of them were put back into Mark V's because they didn't have enough of the engines to go around. Mm-hmm. The production of Mark V's continued on for years afterwards, just on the supply of the motors. And you would have thought these guys were beaten once they were sent off to a squadron of Mark V's. It's like, oh my gosh, what did I do wrong? I'm going off and flying this old heap.
Speaking of pilots like John's dad, Tony Gaze, who was he?
Well, Tony Gaze is a gentleman who's flown this aircraft both at 64 Squadron and later 453, which was an Australian squadron, but he's an Aussie who was up at Cambridge and University at the time when the war broke out, and he decided he was going to join the RAF, and his brother said, wait for me, I'm going to come with you. And they both joined the RAF and became fighter pilots, and his brother didn't survive the war. But Tony went on to do quite a lot. He had 12 and a half victories. He was the first Australian to shoot down a jet, an ME-262, shot down an Arado 234 jet, V-1 rocket, and also was Australia's first jet pilot by the end of the war. He flew this aircraft, and on October 11th, he had a Focke-Wulf, which he'd shot down. And he describes it in the book as the most terrified he'd ever been because he got so close. And in fact, on his logbook, it says, bloody near rammed it. And he got into the contrail and the whole canopy iced up. But it was in a situation where most of the aircraft had a mechanical return to base. So there were only four Spitfires mixing up with a squadron of Focke-Wulfs over France. And now you're sitting there and you can't see anything. And the Focke-Wulf was a very formidable adversary to any aircraft. And you're now at 35,000 feet, you can't see anything, he was just diving down. Now, for this gentleman to say that's the most scared he'd ever been, he later was shot down over near Paris, and he walked all the way to the Pyrenees Mountains, across the Pyrenees Mountains into Spain, with his little resistance-made identity card that said he was an organist, and he was a mute. So if anyone tried to talk to him, well, I can't speak French, I'm a mute. I would have thought that would have been a lot more scary. After the war, Tony came home, and this is kind of the cost of war. His brother didn't. His father didn't meet him at the port. And when he finally saw his dad, he said the wrong brother came home. This is a guy, 12 and a half victory ace, who was flying literally from the Battle of Britain to the end of the war, in combat the whole time, three DFCs, and it didn't live up.
Sitting here with us is Georgina Moore, who is Tony Gaze's niece. Georgina, it's nice to have you with us. How much of any of this history do you have in your ability to chat about Tony's experiences that we just heard something about?
Tony was the most extraordinary man. He grew up with my father. He was very quiet. He was a very tall man. He was 6'4", so to actually fit in was a bit of an effort. He was just incredible in the way that he just took everything in his stride. And the fact that his brother, who didn't make it back, and that terrible thing with his father, who said that he was the wrong one, was devastating, I think, to everyone, really. He loved talking about his time during the Second World War and all the different aircraft. He was just an exceptional, very easygoing man who could do amazing things.
But he would talk about some of these experiences, because we understand there are loads of veterans who have experiences they don't really feel comfortable talking about, but he did.
Yes, he did. He go out for dinner, and he just, you know, he would chat about it. The aircraft, he just loved the Spitfire. The Spitfire was his tool, and he knew, obviously, he knew how to fly it extremely well.
What's this experience like for you and John to be here at Oshkosh with this particular airplane?
It's like reliving Tony's life. I mean, it's the fact that it's here and I'm looking at it, and to think that he actually flew that at the age of 20 and did what he did was, it's bringing back his life. It's the history of the war, and of course, my and Tony.